Welcome to Needle Exchange, the podcast where we dive deep into the minds of textile artists and makers. I'm your host, Jamie Chalmers, aka Mr. X Stitch, and today I'm joined by Melissa English Campbell, an artist whose weaving bends time, texture, and memory. If you've not seen Melissa's work on Instagram, follow her at me_Campbell. And check out her weaving, because it is remarkable. It's unlike anything I've ever seen before. And I was super excited to meet and talk with her. In this first half of our conversation, Melissa shares how her global upbringing and her dyslexia have shaped her approach to weaving, and how painting, layering, and chants all converge in her practice. Before we get going, make sure you follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to share this episode with a fellow creative, I'd be very grateful. I'll be back next week with the second half of my conversation with Melissa. But until then, enjoy the show. Very good. That usually means, you know, it's like we can talk about, you know, how to transpose the diaspora into a medium of 3D textiles, and people can talk about that for hours. And then I'll go, what's the last good book you read? And people are like, oh my God. No idea.
I would have been deer in the headlights if you hadn't prepared me.
Yeah, I think it's fair. Okay. So what I wanted to do with you in particular is, if anybody's listening, what I'd like them to do is stop for a minute. And I would like them to obviously like and subscribe. Now, I'd like them to go to melissaenglishcampbell.com and click on portfolio and click on faces and have a good look around, and then click on integrating and have a good look around, and then click on figures and have a good look around. Because I feel that anybody who's listening to this, like sometimes with my shows, you can kind of take a gamble at what is going to be a great artist and all those sort of things. Your work is something else. To me, your work is something else. And I feel like I want people to be able to look at it so that when I start going, OMG, I don't really understand how you do this. Like your work is stunning. And to me, it's so refreshing because it's like I've seen a fair bit of weaving in my time, but yours seems to be something completely different from my standpoint. Can you explain your work in its entirety?
Oh, sure. No problem.
Nice and easy request.
Oh, geez. let's see. Well, it's weaving as a base. So that's a good place to start. I thread the loom with white yarn, and then I paint on top of it, and I make a slurry of my own with pigments and inks and acrylic gouache. And then I weave it, and I use a double weave structure, which means that there's two layers of painting. So everything I paint twice. And then while I'm weaving, I can pop one layer up above or the other layer, depending. I can respond to what's happening in the yarns, or I have a set pattern and it's all been predetermined and I just have to accept whatever happens with whichever image is popping to the top. So there's those two ways of working. And then I cut it off the loom and I hang it on a wall, and then I respond to it again by painting back on top of it one more time. And occasionally, I will also incorporate a found object, taking yarns from the back that haven't been woven to the front and bringing them forward to wrap around, you know, a found object.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So I have a bunch of questions, because the thing is like everybody understands the concept of weaving at its most fundamental. Erin Riley is a weaver who I greatly admire. Her work is remarkable, you know, the content that she produces. So even from that standpoint, understanding how to structure images with deliberacy and the project management of weaving, that kind of thing, is beyond my comprehension. And it feels like somehow you've then taken it and put in some kind of strange fourth dimension that exists beyond like the normal layers, because as you said, you're painting pictures onto the warp in the first place.
Yes.
Painting two of those and then using those as a backdrop for then weaving something that isn't necessarily the same image.
Right. Yeah, because then those layers interact and the structure of the weaving interact, creating something wholly else, something else. I don't know what to call that.
And I mean, is this a common practice in weaving, or are you sort of a real outlier in this respect?
I think when I first started, I hadn't seen it, but that doesn't mean it wasn't happening. I just was isolated, and I was a grad student, and I was new to research and that world. I wasn't from a textile art world when I went to grad school. But I see a lot more of it now. And I think because of social media, it's feeding me like-minded artists. And I can see how and why people do the same thing. Because if you're a complex dimensional thinker, it is a great way to express your thoughts and your response to, events.
I'm just writing down the phrase complex dimensional thinker, because I want to put that on my CV, on my bio. Yeah, I'm a complex dimensional thinker. Can you unpack that for me? That's a great phrase.
Yeah, all right. I don't know where that came from. That just popped into my head, but I was trying.
So good.
So first of all, I was raised bilingual, so I've got two languages bouncing around in my head, and I'm dyslexic, so things are moving around already. Mm. And I've lived, all over Europe and the United States, and up until the age of 14, I hadn't lived anywhere longer than 2 years, so I have a lot of, geographical changes, cultural changes, language changes, even living in places where I didn't speak the language, so needing to be adaptive. And I also learned to be a bit of a mimic to just survive in different environments. And so there's this instinctive responsiveness to the environment to, just as a...
Like a bit chameleonic or something.
Yeah. So there's that going on. And then, and then I'm also really a strong visualizer. So I can plan out a whole weave structure, rotate it in my head, make changes, and then create it with it already having been 100% in my mind. So there's a lot of dimensions and I can hold them all. And so it becomes a kind of language and a way of expression.
It sounds like it's an amazing side effect of your dyslexia to me. You're like a sort of superpower side effect or something like that.
I think so. The more I learn about dyslexia, the more I agree with you. I didn't know anything about it growing up. I was just that weird kid. And unbelievably frustrating to my professors and my parents, my family. And back in the 70s, dyslexia was just called lazy.
Right,
so there was no compassion for it at all. And there was just punishment for it. So a lot of humiliation in an attempt to get me to focus and do it correctly. And so I didn't know anything about it till I went to university and I took a child psychology class. And I read a statistic in my textbook that some crazy high number, 87% of juvenile delinquents in care are dyslexic. And it's just from misunderstanding, their misunderstanding, society's misunderstanding. And I just felt such a connection to those poor kids. And I started to wonder if I had that. And I still wasn't in any position to get tested or checked or anything. But as I've had my own kids and I've watched friends' children go through testing and diagnosis, and then I started to figure out, that seems really familiar. Mm. And learning more about it, reading about it. And so that's what was going on all those years ago.
No, that's amazing. So you can see the plane that is the warp and the painting that you've got on that. But as you say, so hang on. And again, this is my ignorance. So you have two warps. So how many strands would you have on a warp? Is it like, say, 64, but you'd have 32 on one plane and 32 on another plane? And those...
Yeah, it could work that way. Yeah, they'd be right on top of each other, one on top of each other, layers.
Yeah. And then the shuttle goes, is it a shuttle? Is that what you call it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Your shuttle goes. So When you're calculating your weaving, you're thinking in inches. So if I'm going to do a weaving that's 15 inches wide, sorry, you're probably in metric.
No, we are. We toast the queen when we talk about inches as well. To the queen, even though she's dead. Carry on.
All right. Then what you want to do is count how many yarns are in an inch. So that's called ends per inch. And so 15 to 24 is pretty standard. So one layer will have 15 to 24 yarns per inch, or wow, ends per inch. Okay. And then, so that's one layer. And then underneath, that'll be the same. So so in an inch, maybe I would have 15 ends for one layer and 15 under, so 30 total.
Mm-hmm.
And then times those inches. And so, but it doesn't, once you've warped the loom, you don't have to think about that anymore. That's not something to consider unless sure, you're planning out a pattern and you're bumping up against the limitations of your loom of how many harnesses it has, because the yarns go through the harnesses in a rhythm or a pattern or a sequence. And then you only have so many on a loom, like 8 or 12 or 16. And then those raise a sequence of the yarns. And that's what determines your pattern, what yarn is on top and what gets to be on the face. And that is really easy for me to visualize and work out. And I can't tell you why. But
No. I don't want to know. It's like, it's alchemy. That, again, it's like talking a bit to a fish about rocket science. There's no point. We're on a different thing. Right, okay. But so when you're painting the warps, do you paint one and then raise it and switch it and paint the other? Or do you paint the two together and then separate them apart?
What I do is I set it up at the beginning so that I can pull one layer out onto a table. And what I have to pull them both out at the same time, but then I can roll the top one up out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I paint it like I would a canvas, like a paper. And I treat it as one solid surface. And then once it's dry, I can roll out the top layer. I'll put a layer of plastic between them and I'll paint the top layer. And once that's dry, then I can roll everything back onto the loom and they all come back together as just one warp.
Mm-hmm.
And then depending on my treadling sequence, those layers can either show up as their original painting on the surface, or I can make them meld together, which mm-hmm. I quite like. I like when they join together because there's this amazing element of chance. There's just no way for me to know 100% how they will interact. And then that is sort of, I just like how that reflects life in a way, how, you know, you can have a million plans and you can have it completely sorted in your brain, but then, you know, life, and then you have to respond to that, to whatever it is that popped to the surface. So, that's the exciting part for me.
Yeah. And I mean, I've had quite a few conversations with different artists, and this uncertainty is definitely something that people either thrive on or they choose to turn away from. You know, I think for some people, and I don't know why gold work spring into mind, but it sort of is, there's precision. There's, this is going to be the way it is and I'm going to plan it. Cross stitch is kind of the same. You know what the outcome ought to be. Whereas with this, with all the best will in the world, it's never going to be this perfect thing, because you've got this interplay, what, not only between the two images, but then you've also got the weft going across and the tension that occurs from that. And then presumably that understanding of the space is the area that then you just play around inside.
Yeah. A lot of times I have a pattern in mind and I just let that take over and then I respond to it once it's off the wall. But within the last few months, I've been composing it as I'm weaving. So getting more involved at the weaving level after I've woven it and I'm weaving it. I'm watching to see what's happening, where the gradations are taking shape, and then disrupting that by changing the layer suddenly. And I kind of like that interruption and then that continuation. That, again, it feels current to me for sort of what's happening right now. So that's sort of the direction things have been going recently.
Yeah, that's interesting because that, like, it's making me think about sometimes when people DJ music, they will mix a couple of tracks together, but then you get some people who choose to almost produce the music on the fly or produce the mixes on the fly or produce remixes as they go, kind of feeling it out. And it feels like you're in that, that's like a more experimental arena then.
That is brilliant. I love that because that's what's happening, because the music that they're blending has already been composed and made and exists in the world. But the DJ is the blender. And I guess that's what I'm doing because the painting already exists. The warp is already on there. The loom can only do a certain number of changes and switch ups. But I'm using those, yeah, to mix something.
Mm, yeah. And it's and the one thing, so I mean, when I started looking at your work, a lot of it just felt very glitchy to me. And sometimes I think that's a really amazing thing. You know, you get this discord, you get this pulling of like images that are separated, almost like multiple exposure photography, like those kind of layers. Is that something that was, I mean, was that the desired outcome? Was it a happy byproduct?
Yes. No, I was very much aware of the optical impact of looking at something like that, like a double image. And what I was really interested in exploring was the psychological journey between looking at something, what the heck is that? What am I looking at? That is crazy. I can't make any sense of it. And then the slow like journey towards, because your mind will insist on making sense of it. It will not accept the mystery. And it's going to categorize and it's going to tell you something that you will accept. And so I'm really curious about that journey because that is a memory I have from my youth that I happened so many times because we would be living in one country. A specific memory would be we lived in Tennessee in the backwoods on a hippie commune. Our home was a converted school bus, no electricity, no plumbing. And then we moved to modern Holland and with, you know, cities and electricity and, yeah, a lot of rules. And I remember being taken to my grandmother's house there, and her front door had that corrugated glass. So you know it's glass, but you can't see through it, and it kind of distorts. And my first time, my memory of her coming to that door, walking towards us, I'd never seen textured or corrugated glass before, but I was old enough to remember this. Just I had such a limited experience. I could not figure out what was walking towards us. And I thought, oh, we're just about to meet a monster. We're going to meet some crazy new thing, which totally clocked because I had already been having all these crazy new experiences and seeing crazy new things. And I learned what chocolate was and what canals were. And, you know, I was ready for it. I was ready to meet an alien. And then the door opened and I realized I was So that memory of just all the stages, I guess I'm trying to put that into the work to kind of like make conscious that journey from what the heck to, oh, okay, I see something. Yeah. I don't know. And I can't tell you why that is something I keep exploring, but it's something that definitely is in my work.
So when I've got two daughters, currently 8 and 6, and when the first one was a teeny baby, we got this app that was called the Wonder Weeks. And what you do is you put in their date of birth and then it charts like their brain development processes. So every now and again, a child would have a leap. And usually the main reason you do it is before they have a leap, it's sleep disruption. So just when you think you've got their sleep pattern down, it goes out the window. And that's because their brain's evolving to a new way of thinking. And sometimes it's like it's grasping the concept of distance. So it realizes that once you've gone out of a door, the baby doesn't know whether you're the other side of the planet or you're the other side of the door. It hasn't fathomed that. And then one day it gets that. And one of those stages was just that pattern formation. You know, tiny babies, they look at your face and after a while they start to recognize the triangular pattern of your eyes and your nose. And they can't necessarily distinguish you between or to someone else at that point. But then somewhere down the line, you know, there's another layer where it's like, not all black things are the same. That's a black dog, that's a black cow, you know, and just being able to make those patterns. So I guess that's the same thing that you're doing there, isn't it? But you're maybe starting from a point of familiarity and seeing how far you can take it into unfamiliarity without losing that like cohesion or something.
I am really interested in how much you can disrupt an image and still get information from it. So still recognize the origin source of it. And I think I'm playing with how we trust patterns to tell us things, to predict things. And then I want to see how far I can disrupt that pattern and still reach something, but also make it tell you something new about that object or that portrait.
I was very struck by, there's one piece of someone falling and it's on a purple background. I sort of understand, I guess, how, because there's this whole central section where there's no weft. So it's just the warp and you have it placed in such a way and you've managed to arrange. I mean, Christ knows, really, that must have been a right headache to sort out. But that's a perfect example, isn't it? Because if that piece was stretched equally, it wouldn't really make any kind of sense. But you've managed to then transpose the two elements that are fixed in a grid-like structure and allow that flow and then still make that a pattern that someone can recognize.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, that's just everything I was saying about disrupting pattern. Yeah, we don't expect bodies to turn into noodles and just poop there. But you still recognize something in it as a body. And then it's kind of interesting to accept that and see how,
No, but it's great. So, I mean, with that piece in particular, that, I mean, to me, that feels like some really experimental stuff. I've seen other people who've like played with that kind of form, just allowing forms to dissolve. It's reminded me, there's a guy called Faig Ahmed, who's an Azerbaijani weaver, who sometimes pulls apart the kind of structures of the weave. And I've seen other people who've had things that are just kind of dropping down, a lot of kind of loose thread work. But that feels really experimental to try and maintain that structure, to almost like, it's like pulling it apart like some pizza dough or something, isn't it? Kind of playing with it. Was that idea for that piece, was that something that you were aiming to achieve?
It was not fully planned out. It came together over stages. Initially I wove it and I couldn't see a future in it and I put it away. And then I... You know, as you do, you just kind of revisit things in your mind. I really liked some elements that were happening in it. And I was thinking maybe I'll try and recreate that and then push that somewhere else. But then I thought I would go back to it. And I think sometimes it's a relationship where, you know, things come off the loom or off the wall and it's just, it's not working. You put it away and then you let things just kind of sit fallow for a while or just simmer, or they marinate in the back of your brain. And I've always got a few things going on in my mind of revisiting pieces. And then over time I started to see what it is now. And so then I worked on creating that. And I think what the challenge is that a lot of the themes in my work are about tension and stress and disruption. And fiber is so soft and reliable and continuous and absorbent. And there's this kind of tension there between those two themes. And sometimes I just can't make it work and I have to walk away. It's too much data. Mm-hmm. And then after I've had a little distance, I can come back to it and work it out.
Mm. And so in those situations, do you then just go and work on another project? I mean, do you have like several concurrent projects on the go?
I do. Then? Yeah, I'm always working on three or four things at once.
And are they heading in the same direction? Because, I mean, there are certain, it feels to me anyway, that like there are certain themes in your work where you have these faces that look fairly realistic. You've got a series of like swipes, which is an idea weirdly that I've considered in cross stitch before, of just almost like if you spilled paint over a thing. But I did a thing once which is the closest I could get to it, where it was kind of like a design of, I put a big X across a picture, I think it was of a teapot or something, and then I just inverted the colors inside the X. And that was about as experimental as I got at that point, because my greatest thing is I have ideas and then I sit on them because I don't have any time. And then someone comes along, usually it's Tom Katsumi, shout out to Tom, and does a much better idea than I ever had in the first place. And then I curse him for a day and just move on because I've seen so many ideas. But that idea I really like, that it's almost like a punk thing. It's just like a disrupt. So you've got those. And then you have these much more like woven glitch things where people are sort of becoming disparate, almost like you say, like you can look through those glass. Or to me, sometimes it reminds me of in film, sometimes you might see like a psychological horror thing, multiple images happening at once, people being pulled apart. Are those, mm-hmm. if when you've got, say you've got three or four pieces and they go at the same time, are they all in the same veins, or do you have these different pots that you can dip into depending on your mood and that kind of thing?
I think the answer is yes. I think because, you know, the source material is me and I have only one origin story. It's all going to come from somewhere in there. But also, I do have moods and I do want to respond to beauty and light and synergy sometimes and leave behind stress and tension and disruption. And so I will start off in that direction. Sometimes I'm able to maintain that and it stays there. And other times that stress and that disruption and that search for language enters it. And, you know, I have to let it happen. Yeah. So I guess both ways happen. It's complex. I don't know. Isolating that into one or two like sound bites, I'm not sure I could. I think it's all intermingled. It's like a big soup, you know, and sometimes one flavor pops to the top and that's cool. And sometimes it just doesn't. It's all in there.
It sounds like it's almost like you're going through therapy and you're just allowing these things, these bubbles to rise to the surface and then processing them through the work. One thing that I observe purely from an aesthetic standpoint, though, is your use of colour and the choices that you make. While these works may explore tension, it doesn't feel like a painful tension. You know, I think there might be tensions like the discord we get between the everyday world and stuff. And I mean, some of them as well are very like stretched kind of glitches, almost like you're looking at someone through a shower, like a rain shower, that kind of distortion. But I don't feel any pain. I don't feel any torment. There's a sort of tension, but at the same time, there's a kind of grace to it. You know, there's a calmness in there, if that makes sense.
No, I think that's kind of my personality, I think, is what you're seeing. I am a kind of a calm presence. I have a settled nervous system most of the time, unless I don't, and then I'm in a tizzy, and I've had too much caffeine. But for most part, I have a calmness that I've worked on. But I don't know. I've always just been a watcher and just a calm observer. And so I think that fiber art is kind of perfect for someone with my temperament, because that's kind of what fibers do. You know, they just kind of absorb. They don't reflect back too much. They're not a reflective surface. They're more of a silent presence. And we're completely surrounded by them. We're wearing them. And they can kind of fade into the background a bit, but they also completely identify us. So I feel like it's a really good medium for the kind of language that I use as my form of expression. And I think it's not for everybody, but it's, I don't know that I could, I mean, I do a lot of painting, I do a lot of watercolors, but they're for me, for working things out. And when I'm asked if I want to include them in an exhibition, they don't feel like it's everything I wanted to say, like there's some element missing. For me, I guess there needs to be an element of fiber, something in there to finish saying what I wanted to say.
Unless they create, again, complex dimensional painting, in which case you'll probably be quite good. What are those? Are they like dioramas? You know, when you have like layers and layers and layers, it feels like there'd be something in there.
I think that would be lovely. I'm watching friends make prints onto fabric, mm-hmm. Or even actually one friend is printing directly onto photo paper. and then stitching on top.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really enjoying that effect, that dimensionality that's happening there. So yeah, maybe. And to that, it makes me think of a diorama because you're looking through layers and creating one whole kind of landscape.
I need to connect you with Melissa Zexter, or then there will be a two Melissa situation, and I'm not sure whether that's allowed. Certainly, I know that if there's a three Melissa situation, we have to tell somebody, like fire regulations or something. That's really interesting. Because you kind of became involved in this medium kind of late, isn't it? You didn't like do this as a student or anything.
No, my undergrad was in fashion. Actually, the degree was called environmental design. And then fashion was a little spin-off component of that you could focus on in the program. And so, yeah, I started out in the fashion industry in San Francisco. And then I left all that to raise kids. And so I focused on raising kids. And we also moved. We moved to Iowa, and then we moved to Scotland. So just making homes in different countries. So we lived in Scotland for 5 years.
Whereabouts? And
then in Glasgow.
Okay, good place. Yeah. Love a bit of Glasgow.
Yeah, it took me about 6 months to understand what people were saying.
I think that's reasonable.
And I think they may, not after I figured it all out and I could understand any of the Glaswegian accents, no problem. I started to realize that when they see an American, they put it on, they thicken the accent a bit. So they're having a laugh. And so, it was full immersion. And I picked it up after about 6 months. And the kids had little Glaswegian accents when we left. It was adorable.
Nice. And nobody messed with them because they sounded tough as nails.
Because my six-year-old's going to headbutt you if you mess with him.
I was always conscious of, in Glasgow, if you heard a female voice, you wouldn't know whether it was an 18-year-old or a 60-year-old because it's pretty much sort of sounds the same. Shout out to all the Glaswegians. Okay, yeah. So then after going through all the child rearing and that kind of thing, then you, what, readopted a sort of educational pursuit?
Yeah, so my husband got a job in Ohio here, that's where I am now, at Kent State University, and they have a program where relatives of the employee can use the university for free and get a degree. So it was free education, and I'm one of those people that had a 30-year student loan that I had just paid off when we moved here.
Felt like something was missing. I thought, I know.
And I'm like, what? Free education? That's crazy. And I couldn't pass that up. So I started an MFA program, and they have a textiles program here, which is really lovely. To be honest, had no intention of being a textiles major, but I had met someone really nice who was the head of the program. So she encouraged me to apply. And since it was her program, I went into her program when I got accepted and just dug in and learned how to weave and learn that language. And so about 2.5 years later, graduated, and the fashion school at the university was short, some professors. And so I immediately graduated in December, started teaching in January, became a professor over there, was there for 7 years, and then did that buyout after COVID and became a full-time artist. So I have a fashion background and then all this textile knowledge. And I had started working to exhibit while I was a professor. So I had a little bit of a exhibition history, and I had some clients from commissions, and I just built on that. And yeah, so the textiles thing just happened organically. And because I was in fashion and it's heavily textile oriented, it was a good fit for me as a professor. I was able to use that to help my students and support my students. And then I just stuck with it after I left teaching because it turned out to be such a great vehicle for me language-wise.
So was it when you first tried weaving? Was it one of those, this feels really right kind of moments, you know, the technique?
No, I was terrible at it. The dyslexia was, I don't know how to describe it to you. I couldn't make anything make sense. I can't take verbal instruction. And I can barely read instructions. I can read instructions, but I have to reread them. And as I do a step, I have to reread from the beginning to the step I've just completed and then read the next step.
Right.
So like building a lasagna in the kitchen, I have to start at the beginning of the recipe each time the next layer comes up. So it was so challenging, but refreshingly challenging because I had been a stay-at-home mom. And there are challenges, but they don't challenge your brain so much, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I was hungry for some problems to solve that were not life-threatening. So I was really enjoying it. It was a mess. I was always sitting in a ball of knotted yarn deep into the night. My husband would come and get me with the kids.
Like, a pair of scissors.
Coming home tonight.
Get you out.
But with dyslexia, you like create anchors to keep bringing you back to starting points so that you can progress. And so I just made roadmaps for myself and rules to follow, like, don't do this, never do this. And slowly over time, it became something I could do, but it wasn't natural. And I do have a story from university when I was an undergrad where we did take a weaving class. But there weren't enough looms. You had to team up with someone. So you would trade off to do your assignments. And I was so bad at it. I couldn't do it. But my partner was brilliant. And he did the work for me and turned in my assignments for me. And that was in my early 20s. And something happened in my early 20s to my mid-40s where I was able to calm down enough and focus enough to become a weaver. And I think that was childcare and aging and life experience, and that made it possible to do weaving.